From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Ben Folds of the Ben Folds Five, a rock trio with a sense of humor but no guitars. The band is best known for their song Brick. Also, the Favorite Poem Project. Launched by poet laureate Robert Pinsky, the project hopes to record 1,000 Americans reading their favorite poems. We'll hear excerpts of the kickoff event held last week at New York's Town Hall. It featured a diverse group of readers from celebrities to students. Paul Robeson was born 100 years ago today. Music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews an anthology of his recordings called Songs of Free Men. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. Would you describe one of the nights that you stayed there, what it looked like physically, what it was like to be there?
Well, physically, in this one, I would guess we came down off the railroad track into this thicket, and there were two or three fires and people cooking what they called in mulligan stew. That's probably where it got started, was in the jungles. And some fellows shared their supper with us that night, and we had a little bedroll, and we went over, and some fellows had a lean. There was a lean-to made out of some metal roofing, and leaned over, and so we were in there. We stayed that night. It was not very memorable, and it was pretty miserable. I didn't like it at all.
Jim, you got off the road by joining the CCC, the Civilian Conservation Corps, which was part of FDR's FDR's programs to get the country out of the Depression. Would you briefly describe what the CCC was like and what it offered to you as a teenager?
First place, the Civilian Conservation Corps. It was administered by the United States Army, and I was lucky to serve under people who treated you with what's today called tough love. Man, I don't know, I wish I knew whatever happened to the man by Captain J.B. Entringer. I don't know what would have happened to me if I hadn't had his guidance and discipline. And we were, first camp we lived at, we were up in Merrill, Wisconsin at Camp Newwood, and we did roadside clearing. We put in fire lanes. Did stream renewal, and we did a lot of. There was a lot of soil conservation work done. I think it's fair to say that I doubt if the park system we have in America today would be in existence if it had not been for the Civilian Conservation Corps. Because we left Newwood, we went down to Wausau and built Camp the Rib Mountain State Park. And I stayed in there till I was 19 years old, and then I went back to high school.
Peggy DeHart and Jim Mitchell are both featured in the new documentary Riding the Rails about teenage hobos during the Depression. The film opens September 5th in Los Angeles, September 12th in New York. It will open in other cities over the next couple of months. Coming up, a new book of Vietnamese poetry. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Ben Folds Five is a rock trio with no guitar, led by a pianist who loves punk rock and show tunes and was described in People magazine as fitting somewhere between Little Richard and Billy Joel. Ben Folds is also the lead singer and principal songwriter of the band, which is based in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. After several years of playing small clubs around the country, Ben Folds Five now has a hit with the song Brick from the album Whatever and Ever, Amen. Before we talk with Ben Folds, let's listen to Brick. ¶¶
they call her name at 7:30. I pace around the parking lot and I walk down to buy her flowers and sell some gifts that I got. Can't you see it's not
Ben Folds, welcome to Fresh Air. This song's become a big hit. Is it the song that you would have guessed would catch on?
Yeah, yeah. That's the one when we recorded it, we thought that was a hit.
Why?
I don't know. I think just because it was direct and simple, and we just you know, you get that intangible sort of, yeah, this is a hit sort of feeling, I think. Which, you know, I couldn't claim to have known before because we've never had a hit, but it just seemed that way to me.
It's direct and simple and elliptical.
Yeah.
I had a read that the lyric is actually about a guy whose girlfriend is having an abortion. I didn't pick that up.
Right.
Did you want people to actually pick up the specifics of the story, or did you want it to be more about a mood than something specific?
Yeah, yeah. When I say direct, I mean direct in the feeling. I wanted to be responsible with what I was writing about. I can't write something without writing about something, but at the same time, I like it to be about the feeling more than about the specifics, because I could always write an essay about the subject. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Or maybe I couldn't write an essay, but I could try.
Now, your band is always called Unusual because it's a rock band without a guitar. The piano's at the forefront. I guess what I find interesting is how forward your voice is. In a lot of like guitar-oriented bands, from R.E.M. to Pearl Jam, the voice is kind of mixed into the guitars. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And
your
voice is very, very upfront and very, very clear in the mix.
Yeah. I mean, lyrics are important to me, and I also, I'm not like a strong, like loud singer, and I think it's better if it's all about the song and the words, to go ahead and put the singer way out there, so it doesn't sound as if you're apologizing for something too. I like to just put it way up there, and it's about the song, and that's it.
Why is there no guitar in the band? To me, it doesn't seem that unusual, though I know it's a big deal for everyone. It seems perfectly acceptable to me to have a band without a guitar and to be piano-based.
I think that's a great answer. I mean, we never thought about having a guitar, really. I mean, I'm sure I've answered it in 1,000 different ways, depending on what my mood was. But at the same time, it's just like it really never was an issue. I don't see what's unusual about that either. It's just that there's no guitar, and after all, I mean, who wouldn't want to be a little bit different if possible? You know what I mean? It's like we're not freaks or anything, but I would like to make some kind of niche or something different or offer something different, and the lack of guitar seems to be a nice, you know, a nice change.
Did you once describe the band as punk rock for sissies?
Yeah, and that got quoted a lot for, I guess because it was in our bio. But I think that was that, you know, that was right at a time, too, where to qualify anything new in music, you had to call it punk somehow. It's a weird thing because some of the worst crap bands in the world I've ever heard are punk bands, and I don't want to be a punk band at all. But it was kind of funny that people would equate us with punk in some way, and so I said, well, if we're punk, then it's certainly punk rock for sissies.
I know that there were times, and I don't think you still have to do this, where you had to carry your own piano around with you on tour because you'd play in places where there wasn't a piano or where you were expected to bring a crummy little synthesizer with you.
Yeah.
You don't still have to do that, do you?
No, the first two and a half years that we toured, and we were touring like really, really constantly in the U.S., we carried my piano, just me and the band, and one extra guy. And we carried, it was a baby grand piano, and every single, I'm not talking about like nice clubs, we're talking about like punk clubs and, you know, five bands on the bill and you know, just really kind of not so great conditions, but I think it was a really, really cool context for people to see a real piano in too. The same places that some punk band had played 5 minutes before, you're seeing a real piano, and I think that was kind of a cool thing.
I'm surprised there was room for a grand piano.
Man, you can make room anywhere. It's amazing. We've put it up on like where the legs wouldn't all fit. Just put it up on a chair or on the side of the stage.
Oh,
I mean, we substitute so many things for the legs of that piano. It can be done. Well, we were insane, really. I mean, I think about it. There was something wrong with us.
Why do you say that?
Because the drive and the energy it took to move that piano from state to state was, I mean, I can't believe how much work that was, really, when I think about it. Because you have to get there very early. You have to be in a certain, you know, just the kind of vehicle that you have to drive around and buy to do that. And where you have to park it and getting it up steps and on the stage and after the show, then you're there for like a long time getting it off the stage and into the truck, and it's crazy. It really is a lot of work.
All right. Well, I want to play another track.
All right.
That's right. I want to play another track from your CD. It's a track called Stephen's Last Night in Town. And this is, I first of all, I think the lyric is very funny in this. It's kind of about, you know, the guest who wouldn't leave, the guy who is forgiven for a lot of things because, well, he's leaving town tomorrow, so he could get away with anything.
Right.
And another thing on this track is that a few of the musicians from the Klezmatics, which is a klezmer band, is on this too. So it's a kind of unusual, interesting sound. Tell me about the story, the story behind the song and the arrangement.
Well, Stephen is really Stephen, and he was he's an English guy. He's a friend of mine now. He came through town and just stayed. I mean, it's just like the song says. He stayed for longer than we thought he was going to stay, and it would be like, I'm leaving tomorrow, so can you throw me a party? We'd be like, all right, so we throw him a party. And the next day, like, knock, knock, knock. I'm sorry, I didn't take my plane like I was supposed to, but maybe we should have a party. And after a while, it was kind of like, okay, well, this really is your last night in town, isn't it? And then the Klezmatics, I just heard, well, I've been listening to the Klezmatics for a few years and just loved their music and was looking for an excuse to get to work with them. And that song just seemed to really scream out for that sort of arrangement, although when we wrote the song, the arrangement was nothing like that at all. But yeah, I arranged it. We got the Klezmatics, or as many as we could, down to our house in North Carolina to record. And it was right after a hurricane had just come through, so we thought we were going to have to get a generator to record them with, because we didn't have power in our house until basically right when they arrived.
But it worked out good.
It worked out great. They weren't too happy about recording in a house, I don't think. They're New Yorkers, and they were used to recording in a big studio, so they were kind of like, what, I have no headphone talk back? I'm not going to be penalized for what you don't have.
Well, this is Stephen's Last Night in Town, the Ben Folds 5.
He's charmed everyone here except Tamara Easter, who later revealed to him her innermost secrets. One is over with stories about Linda McCartney, lost points with lays for sin. He couldn't love a woman with cellulite, but we thought he was gone, and now he's come back again. Last week he was funny, and now the joke's wearing thin. Cause everyone knows now that every night now will be Stephen's last night in.
That's a song by Ben Folds, the Ben Folds 5, Stephen's Last Night in Town. I'm wondering if when you started to write songs, or at some point during your songwriting, if you sat down and said to yourself, I want to write songs that are truly about my experience, not songs in the manner of another songwriter. So what are my experiences, and how can I fit that into a song? Could you talk about that a little bit, and maybe choose one of your songs that you feel really talks about, not necessarily your life directly, but your kind of your more general take on life, or you know, something that's connected to your world, as opposed to just an approach to songwriting that would be more secondhand for you?
Okay. Battle of Who Could Care Less. There's a dynamic around everyone that I know who is my age, who is, I guess you have to put in the Generation X category, though that gets to be a really boring, I get sick of hearing about it, but the less you care about something, the more valuable you are somehow. It's a weird little ethic that I don't know how old that is or when it came about, but it's really stifling. If you really try to do something, or you really put effort into something, or you express, you know, that you care too much about something, you'll feel this energy vacuum happening around you where everyone is quietly looking at you like, man, that's not cool. It's kind of like Cats. Not the show, but it's kind of like the way people love Cats because they don't seem to care about them. Or if you have a girlfriend and she seems to be placing too much affection on you, and then one day she doesn't call you, and it's attractive somehow to people. It's a really weird dynamic, and so I just felt like that was just a little too much for me. I don't like playing into that. I don't like acting like I don't care so that I can draw people's energy in. So I wrote that song. That's what it's about, The Battle of Who Could Care Less.
Oh, that's great. Well, let's hear the song. That's Ben Folds 5. We'll talk more with Ben Folds after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Ben Folds of Ben Folds 5. So what was in your parents' record collection? What did they have on the radio? In other words, what was the music you were surrounded with before you were old enough to choose music yourself?
My parents was Ike and Tina Turner, Earth, Wind, and Fire, James Brown, Wilson Pickett, Otis Redding.
You did good.
Yeah, it was all R&B, and I don't think they had a white person in their collection, actually. Maybe Janis Joplin is the closest to a white person singing that I very often experienced at home. Then when I was about, I don't know what age, I started listening to the radio and was completely taken by, you know, like Neil Sedaka and Carole King, and I discovered my white roots at that point, I suppose.
Did you have any guilty pleasures? Or maybe Neil Sedaka is square in that category.
Yeah, I don't know. See, I never really I just got maybe this can be good parents day. I've got good parents. I mean, I didn't learn a lot of really strange things that I think a lot of people learn somehow. And one of them I'm glad I didn't learn until much, much later was the idea of expressing your personality through your record collection or what you listen to. I just liked what I liked. It never occurred to me to be guilty about listening to something until well into my 20s. I started to realize that that's what people did.
I think a lot of bands, when they start out, really want to be different from the kind of spoiled rock stars who are petty and demanding and self-absorbed and so on. And then some of those alternative-type bands get sucked into the same problems when they make it big. I'm wondering if there are certain things that you are pledging not to do and not to be part of.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think the most important thing is just to be yourself. And I think that relaxes things a lot. And that might not make any sense, but there really is something to just being yourself, just relaxing about things. And if you're pouty, to go ahead and admit that that's what you're being. See, that's a good question, though. And I'm really fascinated with that because I'm like at that level where it's kind of like, well, we've got this hit and stuff. And I can see why someone would turn into a rock star baby, you know.
Why? So why?
I think you can't rule out like just circumstantial things like not sleeping, mm-hmm. not being in one place at the same time ever, losing touch with your friends, losing touch with your family, and then basically. You know, stepping off of really kind of subhuman conditions on a bus, which people are like, "Oh my God, you got a bus? That's amazing!" Well, I live in that thing. You know, it's like living with like eight guys on a submarine or something like that, and to step off that, and then all of a sudden you've got these adoring fans standing there, and all of a sudden you know you're in this kind of little I don't know, this little rock star position all of a sudden. It's very strange. It's really strange. I mean, it's weird. And so I can understand why people do that. My thing is though, I don't want to act like somebody else in order to weather it. But I would rather just be something that I think is normal and attainable, you know.
Did you ever go through a period of trying on different personalities before you figured out who you were as a songwriter and performer?
As a songwriter, I've been unable to do anything but be myself. As a performer, yeah, the tendency to, I mean, it's really hard not to go just big rock, you know? It's like do the big rock star bravado thing for me because it's something that, I mean, I think I could be a pretty good actor, and I think I could act like a rock star on stage, and maybe sometimes that happens. But yeah, I've had the tendency to do that, but not in my writing at all. I can't stomach it. I can't sing a song that I didn't mean to write.
Before we heard your song, The Battle of Who Could Care Less, and mm-hmm. you were talking about how you didn't like that attitude of being so kind of aloof.
Yeah.
And never showing a reaction, never being emotionally involved. So I want to end with a song that's kind of the opposite of Who Could Care Less, and that song is Kate. And this has so much energy in it and so much love that's expressed. Mm-hmm. It's a really buoyant song. I quite like it. Would you say something about writing it?
Well, yeah. I mean, this is probably not suitable for radio somehow, but... I mean, yeah, it was right before I got married. At this point, I'm in the middle of the divorce, so there you have it. But at the time, I just I just thought no one seems to write just like adoring, you know, love or crush songs. Not ones that don't have a lot of some kind of. There has to be some kind of irony anymore for people to write just like a crush song or an adoring mm-hmm. song about someone. You know, there has to be a twist, like in the middle, like you realize that he really hates her or he really, some kind of crap like that. And I just thought there's that moment you know, at the beginning where you can see nothing but good, and that's one of the greatest things. And why not just express it in a song and get over not being cool? Yeah.
Ben Folds of the Ben Folds Five. Their latest CDs are Whatever and Ever Amen and Naked Baby Photos, which features outtakes and demos. Last night, the group performed at a Burt Bacharach tribute concert in New York, which will be shown next Wednesday night on TNT. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
What is America to me?
That's Paul Robeson, who was born 100 years ago today. Coming up, music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews the Robeson collection, Songs of Free Men. Also, celebrities and students read their favorite poems. We broadcast highlights of the kickoff event of the Favorite Poem Project, organized by America's Poet Laureate.
The house I live in, the friends that I have found, the folks beyond the railroad, and the people all around, the worker and the farmer, the sailor on the sea, the men who built this country, that's America to me. Of old Abe Lincoln, of Jefferson and Payne, of Washington and Jackson, and the tasks that still remain. The little bridge at Concord, where freedom's fight began, our Gettysburg and Midway, and the story of the town.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. America's Poet Laureate, Robert Pinsky, wants to know what poems we love and why we love them. He's initiated what he calls the Favorite Poem Project. The idea is to create an audio and video archive of Americans from all walks of life reading aloud their favorite poems. The kickoff event was held at New York's Town Hall last Wednesday, the first day of this National Poetry Month. The featured readers ranged from celebrities to students. We're going to play back excerpts of this event. The first people we'll hear reading their favorite poems are Ed Bradley of CBS News 60 Minutes, Luis Rodriguez, a New York City high school sophomore, and Dr. Calvin O. Butts III, pastor of the Abyssinian Baptist Church. Here's Ed Bradley.
I chose a poem by Nikki Finney that is called Uncles because of the uncles I've had in my life. I grew up in what's called today a single-parent home with a mother who gave me everything I needed except that which she couldn't, which was the presence of my father. But there are always male examples in and around our house, uncles who were related by blood and uncles who were part of an extended family and not related at all, except by love and emotion. I remembered my Uncle Bill, my mother's brother, who showed me what education and hard work could accomplish. And I remembered my Uncle Louis, who was of no blood relation to me, but was a friend of the family, who was always there for me, who taught me about right and wrong, who taught me how to play ball, who taught me how to drive a car, and who also showed me how to have some fun in my life. Uncles, Nikki Finney. Mahogany men with massive hands and broad mustaches who outlived wars and married feisty, oak-imaged women, be tight with money, tender of heart, and close to me. A gallery of fathers, each of whom planted me in the well-kept gardens of their youth, moisten the soil with vintage tobacco juice, and ask only that I listen and grow to the rhythms therein. Men of mahogany and oak blossoms, who relaxed late in life and understood that leaning was because of trust, not weakness. Men who, though not supposed to, protected, shielded their oaks because, as they taught me, love is never what it's supposed to be.
What I'm about to read is more like a short story written by Grace Paley. And it's entitled Mother. And recently, about a year and a half ago or 2 years, a very close friend of mine lost his mother to meningitis. And before that, lost his father to AIDS. But his mother's death hit him a lot stronger. And so I only think it's fair that I read this story on behalf of him, since there's a part in the story that says, "Oh, how I long to see my mother standing in the doorway." And I know that many times my friend feels the same way, so. One day I was listening to the AM radio. I heard a song, "Oh, how I long to see my mother in the doorway." "By God," I said, "I understand that song. I have often longed to see my mother in the doorway." As a matter of fact, she did stand frequently in various doorways looking at me. She stood one day just so at the front door, the darkness of the hallway behind her. It was New Year's Day. She said sadly, "If you come home at 4 a.m. when you're 17, what time will you come home when you're 20? And she asked this question without humor or meanness. And she had begun her worried preparations for death. She would not be present, she thought, when I was 20, so she wondered. Another time, she stood in the doorway of my room. I had just issued a political manifesto attacking the family's position on the Soviet Union. She said, "Go to sleep, for God's sake, you damn fool, you and your communist ideas. We saw them already, Papa and me, in 1905. We guessed it all." At the door of the kitchen, she said, "You never finish your lunch. You run around senselessly. What will become of you?" And then she died. Naturally, for the rest of my life, I longed to see her, not only in doorways, in a great number of places. In the dining room with my aunts, at the window looking up and down the block, in the country garden among zinnias and marigolds, in the living room with my father. They sat in comfortable leather chairs, and they were listening to Mozart. They looked at one another amazed. It seemed to them that they just come over on the boat. They just learned the first English words. It seemed to them that he had just proudly handed in a 100% correct exam to the American anatomy professor. And it seemed as though she just quit the shop for the kitchen. I wish I could see her in the doorway of the living room. She stood there a minute, then she sat beside him. They owned an expensive record player. They were listening to Bach. She said to him, "Talk to me a little. We don't talk so much anymore." "I'm tired," he said. "Can't you see? I saw maybe 30 people today, all sick, all talk, 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 talk." "Listen to the music," he said. "I believe you once had perfect pitch." "I'm tired," he said. And then she died. Thank you.
This is a favorite poem. This is the first poem that I ever heard. My parents, both living, just celebrated 50 years of marriage. They had only one child. And he had the pleasure of hearing them read poetry to him, even before I imagine he was able to speak. I like this poem because I wish that many more parents would read poetry to their children. It made a big difference for me. It's made a big difference for my children. I think it would make a huge difference for the children, not only of America, but especially New York City. This is Little Brown Baby by Paul Lawrence Dunbar. Little brown baby with sparkling eyes, come to your pappy and set on his knee. "What you been doing, sir, making sand pies? Look at that bib, you's dirty as me. Look at that mouth, that's molasses, I bet. Come here, Maria, and wipe off his hands. Bees gwine catch up to you and eat you up yet, being so sticky and sweet, goodness lands. Little brown baby with sparkling eyes, who's pappy's darling and who's pappy's child? Who is it all the day never once tries for to be cross ere once loses that smile? Where'd you get them teeth? My, you's a scamp. Where'd that dimple come from in your chin? Pappy don't know you. I believe you's a tramp. Mammy, this hair some old straggler got in. Let's throw him out the door in the sand. We don't want no stragglers lying around here. Let's get him way to the boogeyman. I know he's hiding around here right now. Boogeyman, boogeyman, come in the door. Here's a bad boy you can have for to eat. Mammy and Pappy, we don't want him no more. Swallow him down from his head to his feet. Dad, now, I thought that you'd hug me close. Go back, old booger. You shan't have this boy. He ain't no tramp, nor no stranger, of course. He's Pappy's partner and playmate and joy. Come to your pallet now. Go to your rest. Wish you could always know ease and clear skies. Wish you'd always stay just a child on my breast. Little brown baby with sparkling eyes.
We're listening to excerpts of the kickoff event of the Favorite Poem Project held last week at New York's Town Hall. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
We're bringing you excerpts of the first event in the Favorite Poem Project, launched by America's Poet Laureate Robert Pinsky, recorded last week at New York's Town Hall. The next people we'll hear reading their favorite poems are Don Chiappetta, a former literacy student who's now a national spokesperson for Literacy Volunteers of America, singer-songwriter Suzanne Vega, and writer Garrison Keillor, host of Public Radio's A Prairie Home Companion. Here they are.
Good evening. My name is Don Chiappetta, and I'm an adult learner, and I learned how to read when I was 40 years old. I thank you for this wonderful opportunity, but sitting here tonight, listening to some of these young people read their poetry, I finally realized what a void there was in my life. Never able to read any type of poetry, and just sitting here tonight, listening to some of these people who read such beautiful and heartwarming poetry made me feel real good. The poetry that I'm going to read this evening is a very short one. It means very much to me. I've always set goals for myself, and I was able to accomplish those goals. Follow your dreams. Take one step at a time. Don't settle for less. Just continue to climb. Follow your dreams. If you stumble, don't stop. Don't lose sight of your goals. Press on to the top. For only on top can you see the whole view. Can you see what you've done and what you can do? Can you then have the vision to seek something new? Press on and follow your dreams. Thank you.
So these poems that I wanted to read are by T.S. Eliot. It's called Preludes, and it's about those small moments. To me, these poems are really, even though it doesn't say that they're about New York City, it feels to me like New York City. And the reason these poems have stayed with me all these years is because they remind me of certain points in my life when I was a receptionist and I used to come off work at 5 o'clock. And walk to the subway. There's certain moments in the city that these poems remind me of. And that's why I really love them. Preludes 1. The winter evening settles down with smell of steaks in passageways. 6 o'clock. The burnt out ends of smoky days. And now a gusty shower wraps the grimy scraps of withered leaves about your feet. And newspapers from vacant lots, the showers beat on broken blinds and chimney pots, and at the corner of the street, a lonely cab horse steams and stamps, and then the lighting of the lamps. 2. The morning comes to consciousness of faint, stale smells of beer from the sawdust-trampled street with all its muddy feet that press to early coffee stands. With the other masquerades that time resumes, one thinks of all the hands that are raising dingy shades in 1,000 furnished rooms. 3. You tossed a blanket from the bed. You lay upon your back and waited. You dozed and watched the night revealing the 1,000 sordid images of which your soul was constituted. They flickered against the ceiling. And when all the world came back and the light crept up between the shutters and you heard the sparrows in the gutters, you had such a vision of the street as the street hardly understands, sitting along the bed's edge where you curled the papers from your hair or clasped the yellow soles of feet in the palms of both soiled hands. 4. His soul stretched tight across the skies that fade behind a city block, or trampled by insistent feet at 4 and 5 and 6 o'clock, and short square fingers stuffing pipes, and evening newspapers and eyes assured of certain certainties, the conscience of a blackened street, impatient to assume the world. I am moved by fancies that are curled around these images and cling, the notion of some infinitely gentle, infinitely suffering thing. Wipe your hand across your mouth and laugh. The world revolve like ancient women, gathering fuel in vacant lots. Thank you.
I've chosen a poem by James Wright, who was my teacher at the University of Minnesota, a poem that I've seen often in print, that I saw once crocheted on a pillowcase for sale in a craft shop in Red Wing, Minnesota, that I heard recited at a wedding in Minnesota by the bride to the groom, a wedding that was held in a pasture at which horses were present. That I saw at the Minnesota State Fair in the crop art competition. It was written in rye seeds that were glued to a piece of plywood against a background of flax seeds. And I've seen it most recently written out on a bronze tablet that, at the instigation of teachers and librarians in southern Minnesota, has been erected at a wayside rest by the Minnesota State Highway Department. So it's a poem that has had many lives and that seems to have a chance to survive, at least in southern Minnesota. It's a poem entitled, A Blessing. Just off the highway to Rochester, Minnesota, twilight bounds softly forth in the grass, and the eyes of those two Indian ponies darken with kindness. They have come gladly out of the willows to welcome my friend and me. We step over the barbed wire into the pasture where they have been grazing all day alone. They ripple tensely. They can hardly contain their happiness that we have come. They bow shyly as wet swans. They love each other. There is no loneliness like theirs. At home once more, they begin munching the young tufts of spring in the darkness. I would like to hold the slenderer one in my arms, for she has walked over to me and nuzzled my left hand. She is black and white. Her mane falls wild on her forehead. And the breeze moves me to caress her long ear that is delicate as the skin over a girl's wrist. Suddenly I realize that if I stepped out of my body, I would break into blossom.
Garrison Keillor, we've been listening to excerpts of the first event in the Favorite Poem Project, organized by U.S. Poet Laureate Robert Pinsky. The event was held April 1st at New York's Town Hall, where it was presented by Pinsky, the Academy of American Poets, the American Poetry and Literacy Project, and Teachers and Writers Collaborative. Our thanks to them all for letting us broadcast the readings. The recording was produced for Fresh Air by Naomi Person. Coming up, music by Paul Robeson. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Today is the 100th anniversary of the birth of the great African-American singer, actor, and political activist, Paul Robeson. He died in 1976, a largely forgotten victim of Cold War politics. He's now being rediscovered. His films are being shown on TV and in theaters around the country. And a multimedia exhibit on his life and work has just opened at his alma mater, Rutgers University. Our classical music critic, Lloyd Schwartz, has been a longtime admirer of Robeson's art. Here's Lloyd's thoughts.
There is a balm in Gilead to make a wounded whole. There is a balm in Gilead to heal a sin-sick soul.
As with certain profoundly challenging American artists like Orson Welles, Paul Robeson's career began brilliantly and ended in disappointment. The son of a runaway slave, he graduated from Rutgers as valedictorian and the school's first All-American football player. He got a law degree at Columbia, then left his law practice when, according to his biographer Martin Duberman, a stenographer refused to take dictation from a nigger. Instead, he became a star, a multi-talented actor and singer. Good thing, too, since his powerfully resonant, articulate bass baritone was one of a kind. Eugene O'Neill cast him in several plays, most notably The Emperor Jones, which became one of Robeson's 11 films. He's remembered with awe for playing Othello on Broadway. His most famous role was Joe in Showboat, which he also filmed. He did the London, but not the Broadway premiere, so he didn't actually introduce Old Man River. But it became his theme song. He even changed the words. Here's his 1947 version, which is included on a Paul Robeson CD called Songs of Free Men, in Sony's remarkable Masterworks Heritage series.
You and me, we sweat and strain, body all aching and racked with pain. Tote that barge, lift that bale, get a little drunk, and you land in jail. But I keeps laughing instead of crying. I must keep fighting until I'm dying, and Old Man River, he just keeps rolling along.
The CD reproduces the original album cover of Songs of Free Men, which shows a manacled, dark-skinned fist holding a dagger and stabbing a snake with a swastika. The original 1942 album had only 8 numbers, 2 American songs, a Spanish Civil War song, a song from the German concentration camps, and 4 Russian songs, among them the famous Red Army Song of the Plain, all of which Robeson sang both in English and their original languages. He spoke 20 languages. The CD also includes spirituals and folk songs, theater songs like the Gershwin's It Ain't Necessarily So, art songs and songs of a political or social caste. In 1942, Robeson wrote, "The particular songs in this album have that folk quality and show in no uncertain way the common humanity of man. Beyond this, they issue forth from the present common struggle for a decent world, a struggle in which the artist must also play his part."
Open field.
prairie. Heroes go riding across the prairie. Yes, with the Red Army go the heroes.
Robeson was a worldwide spokesperson against racism. But after World War II, his outspoken leftist, pro-Soviet sympathies were intolerable to the Cold War Congress. He was a major figure on the international concert circuit. So in 1950, our State Department revoked his passport. He couldn't travel, and the ensuing controversies made him unemployable here. His passport was reinstated in 1958, but it was too late. He was just awarded a posthumous Lifetime Achievement Grammy, but the plan to honor him on a U.S. postage stamp was turned down, which means he might still be regarded as some kind of threat, which might be just how every great artist ought to be perceived.
Lord Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed Paul Robeson's Songs of Free Men from Sony's Masterworks Heritage Series. I'm Terry Gross.
Lord God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, this day let it be known that thou art God, and that I am thy servant.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.